From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, remembering Katharine Hepburn, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer A. Scott Berg. He was a friend of Hepburn's during the last 20 years of her life. She agreed to let him write about the stories she confided as long as he didn't publish until after her death. He complied, and his completed book remained in a vault. It's just been published. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD from tenor saxophonist Virginia Mayhew. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The Justice Department today refused to produce an al-Qaeda prisoner for questioning by terrorism suspect Zacharias Moussaoui. The move is in defiance of a judge's order, and it could trigger legal punishments. Among other things, the judge could dismiss the government's charges in the only U.S. case to come out of the September 11th terrorist attacks. President Bush today has given the strongest indication yet that the U.S. will send some troops to Liberia. The troops would aid with peacekeeping in that West African nation. NPR's Don Gagne has more from the White House.
Liberia was the dominant topic in an Oval Office meeting between the president and U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan. The president did not specify what the U.S. role will be in Liberia. He did say any possible U.S. presence would be in support of the primary peacekeeping force to be supplied by the Economic Community of West African States, known as ECOWAS. Mr. Bush said he's awaiting a report from a U.S. assessment team.
Our teams, our military, is assessing ECOWAS strength. How soon, how quick, what kind of troops, who they are, to determine what is necessary from our side to fulfill the commitment I have made that we will help maintain the ceasefire. By the way, this is conditional upon Mr. Taylor leaving.
The president said the U.S. role will be limited in tenure and in size, and that U.S. forces would not be under the command of the United Nations. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
There was an explosion in Baghdad today, near where the country's new governing council was meeting. The blast destroyed an empty car that officials say belonged to Tunisian embassy officials. No injuries were reported in the blast. In western Baghdad, meanwhile, an American soldier was killed and six others wounded when several rocket-propelled grenades were fired at a military convoy early this morning. The Bush administration is challenging a federal judge's ruling affecting the Missouri River. Under that ruling, the Army Corps of Engineers would be required to reduce the amount of water flowing in the Missouri this summer. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
The Army Corps of Engineers usually releases enough water into the Missouri River during the summer to maintain a 9-foot channel that can accommodate barge traffic. Environmentalists say those higher flows hurt the survival of an endangered fish, the pallid sturgeon, and submerged river sandbars on which two endangered bird species, the least tern and the piping plover, build their nests. Environmental groups sued under the Endangered Species Act, and over the weekend, a federal judge ordered the Corps to begin releasing less water from reservoirs on the upper part of the river. That ruling conflicts with a federal appeals court decision issued last month, which ordered the Corps to maintain a flow high enough to protect barge traffic. The Bush administration is asking for a stay on the order so it can reconcile the two decisions. Greg Allen, NPR News, Kansas City.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials finished up 57 points, that's over 1%, to close at 91.77 in active trading. The Nasdaq, meanwhile, closed up 21 points, finishing the day at 17.54. This is NPR News. Wildfires continue to plague several western states. Flames are threatening some 150 homes near Yakima, Washington today. That blaze has already burned more than 1,900 acres. In western Wyoming, a 23-mile section of a major road there was finally reopened today after smoke from a nearby wildfire finally lifted. And in Oregon, one campground has burned to the ground and more damage is threatened by a forest fire that broke out on Sunday. From Eugene, Oregon, Morgan Smith reports.
After destroying a popular campground, the 650-acre Clark Fire, fanned by warm winds, is threatening two other campgrounds and spreading toward a horse and cattle ranch. Linda Townsend, who works at the local grocery store, says the ranch owner is preparing to lose his home to the flames sometime tonight.
So they just kind of let their animals loose because they've got horses and stuff up there so that they can run from the fire, and then they try and round them up later.
Townsend says this is the second time in 3 years homes in the area have been evacuated due to fire. Helicopters are bucketing water in, and planes are dropping retardant in support of over 80 firefighters working on the ground. So far, no injuries have been reported. For NPR News, I'm Morgan Smith in Eugene.
Weather forecasters are expanding the hurricane warnings for tropical storm Claudette. Claudette is growing in strength and is expected to become a hurricane by the time it reaches the Gulf Coast of Texas sometime tomorrow. Some 200 miles of shoreline are now under that warning. Several oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico are reporting hurricane-force winds a few hundred feet above the water surface. American Lance Armstrong continues his overall lead in the Tour de France. Today he was almost injured when a rival had an accident in front of him. Armstrong rode his bicycle into a field before finishing that leg. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Saab. Welcome to the State of Independence, where all cars are turbocharged. Information and dealer locator at saabusa.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, biographer A. Scott Berg, was a friend of Katharine Hepburn's during the last 20 years of her life. She agreed to let him write about her, but she shared many stories and sentiments that she felt should not be made public until after her death. Berg honored her request. Last week, just days after her death, he published his book, Kate Remembered. Berg won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Charles Lindbergh. He's also the author of biographies of film producer Samuel Goldwyn and editor Maxwell Perkins. Let's start with a scene from the 1949 comedy Adam's Rib, featuring Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. He plays a prosecutor, she's a defense attorney. Their marriage turns into a contest when they take opposite sides of the same case, a woman accused of shooting her unfaithful husband. Here's the couple getting ready for bed.
Said the same thing 9 times.
Oh, well, the 10th time, and will you please stay out of this Attinger thing, darling? Will you please?
Did you have to sulk all evening?
Look,
with a growl on your face?
How could a man have a growl on his face? If you think you're going to turn a court of law into a Punch and Judy show,
darling,
I want to tell
please,
you, you don't.
Please, this means a great deal to me.
Yes, would you?
And
would
it's
you,
not a stunt.
Would you?
This
would
poor
you,
woman, isn't yeah, she entitled to the same justice? I mean, that's usually reserved for men. The same unwritten law that got Lenihan off.
Would you?
I know what
please,
you're going to say.
Please,
that he
please,
should have been convicted,
just,
too,
just
but he wasn't.
Couldn't
and you're
I,
not going to put this
just,
poor soul away
yes,
just because she had the misfortune
small,
to be born a
just
female.
Just one word in
now,
it.
If I could
wise,
help it.
Couldn't
what?
I? Could I please get a word in edgewise?
Go ahead.
Not one syllable. Not one syllable of
you're
what you have been blabbering here tonight.
You always do that when you get excited.
I am going to cut you into 12 little pieces and feed you to the jury, so get prepared for it.
Good night, Pinky.
Oh, good night.
I asked A. Scott Berg why Katharine Hepburn wanted him to wait until after her death to publish his book about her.
Katharine Hepburn and I really engaged in rather personal conversations from almost the moment I met her 20 years ago. And I think as time went on and she realized she was getting more and more personal in what she was revealing, and some of the things got a little more intimate, some more sensitive, I think she always wanted me to write about it, but I think she felt some of that material should just wait until she was no longer present. I think some of it involved perhaps, I think, people who were still alive, and she didn't want to be alive for that. But I think more to the point was that she just felt it was inappropriate in a way. And that the story wasn't finished, really, until she had died.
Did you show any of it to her?
I never did show her any of what I had written. And in fact, it was really a process of my taking notes over the last 20 years. And it really wasn't until about 1999 that I began to pull all those notes out of a drawer and put them all together and turn it into a book. So, no, she never saw a word of it that I had written. I should also add that this was a book she wanted published not just after her death, but as much as possible upon her death.
What? Why?
This was something that came up a few times, and I have a hunch it came from her watching what happened to her really dear friend and former love, Howard Hughes. And I think she saw in the last few decades of his life, how Hughes had been turned into something of a caricature. You know, there were so many urban legends about him. You know, the long fingernails, the hair. Was he keeping jars of his urine? Was he walking around with Kleenex boxes on his feet? And all this. And it really pained her to see this brilliant man become the subject of some ridicule. And I think she figured if I were able to write something and put it out there right away, it would provide at least a template of fact, so that if any other books come along, if there were any articles, if any of the scandal sheets were going to write something about how she spent her last years and this and that, it would have to operate from this base of facts that I have put out there.
When you first met her 20 years ago, and you met her because you had expected to do an Esquire magazine profile of her, you asked her about her relationship with Spencer Tracy, and she told you, "That's something I never talk about." But she eventually did talk with you about her relationship with him. Why do you think she always kept that off the record until she talked to you?
I think she kept it off the record mostly because it was deeply personal. Katharine Hepburn, from a very early age, really almost from the moment she broke into motion pictures in 1932, had almost created this character, this persona of Katharine Hepburn. And I think she was always willing to put that out there in public. The Spencer Tracy of it all, especially the five last years of Spencer Tracy's life, were something so private, so personal, so between just the two of them. I think she always felt that to have put that out there was to reveal the real human being beneath the persona of Katharine Hepburn. Now, they were, in fact, rather similar creatures. But there were some nuances, and there were some just private things that I think she felt were her business and nobody else's. So I was a little surprised when, actually, my very first weekend visiting with her at her country house in Fenwick, Connecticut, just outside of Old Saybrook, that she began, the first thing she talked about was her relationship with Spencer Tracy. And I viewed that as her way of saying, look, I've opened my door to you. Now I'm really going to open it wide. I'm now going to start to tell you things. And I hope you're going to get all these down, because I'm probably going to tell these stories just once. And I want you to hear them, and I hope you'll do something with them. That was the tacit understanding I had.
He had a reputation for boozing and for womanizing. How did she handle that?
Well, he did have a reputation, certainly within the Hollywood community. I don't think it was all that well known outside of the Hollywood community. You know, Spencer Tracy, he wasn't a matinee idol, certainly. He was hardly a beauty. And most movie watchers really knew him in his later years, where he was this rather white-haired, flat-footed guy, you know, sort of the all-American Joe. But he did, in fact, have lots of affairs with lots of rather beautiful actresses, and he did drink a lot. The question how she dealt with it is, I think, as well as she could. I think when it came to the other women, and there were a few others after they took up with each other during their 25-plus, 26 years, I think she tended to look the other way at that. The drinking, I think, she was able to modulate a bit when she was with him. There's no question, as she told me, and others over the years had told me, Spencer Tracy drank a lot less when Katharine Hepburn was around, when she wasn't off making a picture or off on Broadway doing a show or something. I think he had certain abandonment issues, in fact, which really provoked a lot of the drinking.
You write, she became supportive of Tracy in ways that sometimes forced her to be servile, patient to an extreme, that often left her patronized and devoted until she was sometimes reduced to a life in denial. She was periodically subjected to his humiliations, occasionally in front of others. What kinds of things are you referring to?
I'm referring to sometimes they would go out and he would get drunk and or drink a lot, and she would say, start to speak, and he would kind of shut her up. He would be dismissive. Or she would try to be helpful, and in her helpfulness, she'd be overly eager and sometimes do too much, and he would just say, you know, sit down, that's enough, you know, enough already, shut up. And so I think sometimes he just put a cork into her, that sort of thing. And it wasn't ever in a big public place, because they never really went to those places together, but at dinners or whatever in front of friends, many people saw that behavior from Spencer Tracy, and she just quietly took it.
They lived together without being married because Tracy didn't want to divorce his wife. Did Hepburn have any reservations about doing that at a time when it was considered socially and ethically unacceptable?
I don't think she really did have any compunctions about that. And the fact of the matter is, and this was something she said several times to me, had she said it one more time, I think she would have protested too much. And that is, she never wanted to marry Spencer Tracy. She had had this one marriage to this rather sweet man, a Philadelphian, and that was fine. That was enough. I think she felt, as she often said, that she was much happier living like a man. I mean, men could go through life and be serially monogamous or not even monogamous. And when she finally found somebody she wanted to settle down with, I think she figured, fine, I really don't want to live with him. The lack of conventionality to it all, I think, was something that probably delighted her, in fact. I think the only thing that might have occurred to her is, might this in some way have affected their careers? And for some peculiar reason, the Hollywood press, the gossip columnists, the Luella Parsons, Hedda Hoppers, those people, they chose never to write about it. And it really was Hollywood's best-kept open secret.
Why do you think that the gossip columnists allowed Katharine Hepburn to have that freedom?
Because I think those gossip columnists really admired Katharine Hepburn for it. I think part of them were privately cheering, you know, you go, Kate, that's great. You know, I wish I could do that, or I wish other women could do that. I mean, Hepburn was really one of the very few women who could go out there and do it, who could. I mean, if a man were doing it, it wouldn't have even been looked at twice. But for a woman, that was another matter. And I think because so many people in the Hollywood community and in the newspaper community respected her so much as an actress and just sort of as a human being, as somebody with really strong personal values, I think they were inclined to let it go and feel in some ways this was their contribution to letting that relationship exist in peace and quiet.
My guest is A. Scott Berg, author of the new book, Kate Remembered. We'll talk more about Katharine Hepburn after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is A. Scott Berg, and his new book is a memoir about Katharine Hepburn. And he was a close friend of hers for, a little more than 20 years. The new memoir is called Kate Remembered, and there was an understanding between him and Hepburn that he would write about her, but that he wouldn't publish the book until after her death. So the book was actually all ready to go when she died. Another subject of speculation about Katharine Hepburn's life has been over her sexuality. There have been questions raised for years about whether she was bisexual. And you write about several very close relationships she had with women, friends, including with her her longtime assistant. And you don't really imply that that Katharine Hepburn was bisexual. On the other hand, if you read between the lines, there is the possibility of it, and you don't say definitively one way or another. Do you think that some of these relationships might have actually been intimate?
My hunch is some of them might have been. To be perfectly honest, I have absolutely no knowledge of her having any bisexual relationships. As Hepburn herself often said, nobody can really know what goes on between two people when they're alone in a room. That's true of bisexuals, homosexuals, heterosexuals. I mean, who knows what happens when the door is closed, what actual physical act is taking place. It is one area that I never asked her questions about, and she never offered information about. Now, that being said, our very close mutual friend, Irene Mayer Selznick, who was a contemporary of Kate's, did come to feel in the end, she came to a kind of realization after seeing a young woman in Hepburn's house, that whether they were actually having sex or not was almost immaterial, but there was a level of intimacy anyway that Irene Selznick picked up between Hepburn and this woman. It made Irene think, well, gee, maybe that explains a lot of things over the last 50 or 60 years, and perhaps there's a history of that. But in the end, I don't think it was, I don't know, I have no facts on the subject. I just have my own feelings. The one thing I do know definitively is that there was definitely no relationship with Phyllis Wilburn, her companion. I mean, she went home every night to her own place. She was really there as an employee who became an extremely close friend, but there was absolutely nothing physical about that relationship.
Yeah, in fact, you write that Katharine Hepburn had said, "This is Phyllis, my Alice B. Toklas." and Phyllis, her assistant, said, "Wait a minute."
"Don't say that. That makes me sound like an old lesbian, and I'm not." And Katharine Hepburn says, "You're not what, old or a lesbian?"
How do you feel about the fact that your memoir kind of implies the possibility of it without saying definitively one way or another?
Well, I felt had I not raised the subject in my book, I would have been accused of trying to whitewash something, of trying to really gloss over an important part of one's psyche and one's life. On the other hand, I didn't want to go out there and be either sensational or speculative when it's clearly something, and I try to make clear, I just don't have firsthand knowledge of. And because this is a memoir, it is nonfiction. Everything in this book is as factual as I can make it, passed through my lens. I just didn't feel I could go any farther than that.
Throughout the book, throughout your memoir about Katharine Hepburn, you really get the sense here is a very independent woman who's going to go her own way and not care very much what other people say about her, although she doesn't particularly want to be the subject of speculation or gossip. How much of that independence and nonconformity do you think comes from her family, her parents?
Oh, I think 99.8% of it probably comes from that. Well, let me put it this way. She certainly believed most of it came from that.
Mm-hmm.
She grew up in a somewhat eccentric family. That is to say, politically, socially, they were not of the center. And they were very strong parents who really endowed all six of their children with a great sense of personal identity. She was extremely forthright as a child, really. From the time she was out of Bryn Mawr College and had decided she wanted to become an actress, she always kept her eyes on the prize, and I think she always knew where she was headed and always drew a roadmap to get her there.
Now, you write that she thinks that her father held back her mother. They were both very strong, independent people. Her father was a surgeon who also did a lot of educational work on venereal disease. Her mother was a birth control activist, an early birth control activist. But Katharine Hepburn told you that she feels her mother could have done more had not her father held her back. What was she describing there?
Yes, and I should hasten to add that this is one paragraph in which I do a little extrapolating. I should say that Katharine Hepburn, I never heard her really utter a word that wasn't highly in praise of each of her parents. That being said, I always felt there was something between the lines. I always felt there was a lot not being said. And over the years, as I was trying to piece it together, what I think I was coming up with, and what I felt comfortable enough to put in my memoir, is that Katharine Hepburn's father, who was a rather progressive man for his day, and really urged his wife to get involved in some cause, to really go out there, to become something of a public figure. And she became a really wonderful activist and an extremely articulate advocate. But there was a moment where she really could have gone out there and become a national figure. That would have meant, however, leaving a half dozen children at home and going around the country stumping. And I think he kind of drew the line there. And that is, you know, I think our children should have a mother at home. And he was very big on every afternoon leaving the office and having tea, having kind of children's hour with all the kids and with his wife. So to that extent, you see, it's kind of a catch-22. I mean, he really wanted her out there, but he wanted her at home. And to some degree, I always got the strong sense that Kate felt he had, ironically, held her back to some degree.
I'm sure she probably wanted her mother around when she was growing up at the same time.
I think that's it. And again, there's the catch-22 again. I mean, Katharine Hepburn was always so grateful, and she often talked about how I had two strong parents at home for me. On the other hand, she sort of wished her mother could have been almost a Katharine Hepburn-like figure, could have been a woman out there wielding a sword and carrying on the crusade.
Now, a lot of women who don't have children are warned that later in life, when they get old, they're going to really regret it. Did Katharine Hepburn ever regret her decision to not have children?
We talked about this a bit, too. I don't think she regretted not having children. I should hasten to add that there's no question, however, that at the time I met her, which was in 1983, when she was 75 years old, I think she was looking around and she saw most of her friends were dead or dying. And while there were lots of people running in and out of the house and in and out of her life all the time, there were very few people filling the role of what might be a child. And I think that's one of the reasons the door got opened to me. I was 33 years old at the time, and I think she felt to some degree I could fulfill some of those filial, not even responsibilities, but just fill in emotionally for her as a kind of son, perhaps, although I never felt that she was being motherly toward me or grandmotherly toward me. But I think she came to the realization toward the end of her life that there were certain holes. There's no question about that.
A. Scott Berg is the author of the new book, Kate Remembered. We'll talk more about Katharine Hepburn in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Elegant Gathering of White Snows, a novel about eight women whose impromptu walking quest touches a nation, by Chris Radish. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, A. Scott Berg shares more reminiscences of Katharine Hepburn, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD from tenor saxophonist Virginia Mayhew.
Bye.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with A. Scott Berg. He's just published his book about Katharine Hepburn called Kate Remembered. He was a friend of hers for the last 20 years of her life. She shared many confidences and agreed to let him write about her as long as he waited until after her death to publish the book. He honored that request. His book has just been published. Berg won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Charles Lindbergh and is also the author of biographies about producer Samuel Goldwyn and editor Maxwell Perkins. Let's pick up where we left off. Another subject of speculation surrounding Katharine Hepburn's life was the suicide of her brother. Katharine Hepburn actually discovered her brother's body after he killed himself. She was 13 at the time. Did you talk with her about that and about the after effects on her emotionally to have been the person who discovered the body and to know that her own brother killed himself?
We did talk about that. And she even writes about it to some degree in her autobiography, Me. And she basically subscribes to what has been the family lore, that it was an accidental suicide, that he had been trying some trick he had seen performed in which you pretend to be hanging yourself, but because of the way you've tied the knot and constricted your neck, you're not really doing any harm. We talked about it on a couple of occasions, and actually, by the second conversation on the subject, she made it clear to me that she really thought deep down that he had intentionally committed suicide, and that he was not quite like the rest of the Hepburns, that he was not charged up the way the rest of them were, and that he was probably a troubled soul. And I think by the time we finished talking, I always had the strong sense that in her mind she had come to rest with that fact. In the case of her brother's suicide, she did what all the other Hepburns always did, which was on with the show. Okay, it's happened. He's dead. There's nothing you can say or do about it. But I think the more I thought about it, and it did come up on a few more occasions, I think she began to see that perhaps this was something that really helped propel her. It made her in some ways more energetic, maybe doubled her own horsepower. I've known a few people who have been siblings of suicide victims in their teens, and this is really just anecdotal evidence I'm passing on here. But I found they all had a similar trait, and that is they were all sort of overcharged, as though they were living for two people. And I often felt Katharine Hepburn had that quality.
You talk to her about her film career as well as her personal life. Is there a favorite film anecdote that you can share with us?
Well, I think my favorite film anecdote, because it's my favorite Katharine Hepburn film, has to do with the Philadelphia Story, which is an interesting film in so many ways. It's almost the fulcrum of her life and career, because Hepburn had been in Hollywood for about 6 or 7 years, had made a flurry of films, 3 or 4 really wonderful ones that were huge hits, but a dozen of them that were big flops. And by 1938, the independent theater owners in America had voted Katharine Hepburn box office poison, which sounds fairly harmless, but the fact of the matter is they were taking out big broadsheets, big billboards, putting them all over Hollywood saying, please don't make movies with, and they listed several people, Joan Crawford, Marlena Dietrich, Katharine Hepburn. And indeed, the studios were thinking, gee, we're not going to make movies with Katharine Hepburn anymore. She left Hollywood. She went back to Fenwick. And while she was there, a playwright she knew, Philip Barry, came and wrote the Philadelphia Story for her. Hepburn, very cleverly, and with the assistance of her then-boyfriend, Howard Hughes, bought up the film rights for it. Now, this is where the story starts to get really interesting. I mean, we see the Philadelphia Story today, and it looks like this absolutely perfect movie. And for me, it is. I think it's the ultimate romantic comedy. And you see the casting of it with Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart as the two guys she's torn between. And you can hardly imagine anyone else playing those roles. But what she discussed with me was, when she tried to get that film made, she went around to all the studios and said, look, I'm still box office poison. I need a comeback. This is my comeback vehicle. What stars have you got? I mean, all the studios desperately wanted to make the movie. They just didn't want to make it with Katharine Hepburn. So she went to Louis B. Mayer at MGM, and who desperately wanted to do the film. And she said, well, gee, you have Spencer Tracy and Clark Gable under contract. I'd like to make Philadelphia Story with them. I don't care who plays which part. And Mayer came back and said, well, sorry, they're both busy. In fact, neither of them really wanted to make the movie, I think in part because Katharine Hepburn was still box office poison. Samuel Goldwyn, the film producer, he said, I've got Gary Cooper under contract. And Hepburn thought, great, I'll take Gary Cooper. He's a big star. I'd love to work with him. But Gary Cooper, he didn't want to make the film either. Warner Brothers even put up Errol Flynn. And just as that was about to happen, L.B. Mayer came back and said, look, I really want to make the film. You can do it. Here's $150,000. You go out and cast it however you can with that money. And she called up her friend Cary Grant, with whom she had made Holiday and Bringing Up Baby, and he was willing to do it. And they had a little money left over for Jimmy Stewart, who was not the big Jimmy Stewart yet that we now know. And so they ended up in the film. Ironically, Jimmy Stewart has won one Academy Award in his entire career, and it was opposite Katharine Hepburn in The Philadelphia Story.
Now, in addition to reviving Katharine Hepburn's career, The Philadelphia Story also helped to establish her persona on screen as somebody who was from a kind of privileged background, very smart, very funny, a real life force, but at the same time, a little self-absorbed, headstrong, and untamable. How much do you think her real personality coincided with that screen persona?
I think there's truth to everything you say, and I think a lot of her personality really overlapped that screen persona. The one thing you've got to remember, and you can see it in the very opening of The Philadelphia Story, is that Katharine Hepburn was always the first who could laugh at that persona. And in fact, when they were trying to come up with an opening for it, you know, there's this famous opening where basically Katharine Hepburn is throwing Cary Grant out of the house, and finally the golf clubs go out, and she cracks the clubs right over her knee. And you think the scene is over, and then Cary Grant comes up to her and pushes her in the face, and as she said, pushed me right on my ass. She said, because that's where the public wanted to see me. And she knew that. She knew that she played uppity really well, but she knew she had to cut that all the time. And I think that's part of the secret to her success, not just as a film star, but as a kind of cultural figure as well. She knew she could put a lot of feminism out there, but she always had to temper it somehow.
Or get her comeuppance in the end. Or be tamed, you know, in the very end of the film.
That's it. I'll tell you where I think it makes its strongest point is at the end of Woman of the Year, where she is this very tough, can-do-everything woman who finally marries Spencer Tracy. And there's one scene of her alone at the end of the film in which she's now married to Spencer Tracy. She's this brilliant, globe-trotting journalist, now married to Sam Craig, the sports writer. And it's her first morning as Mrs. Craig, and she has to make breakfast for him. And it's Katharine Hepburn alone in a kitchen for 5 minutes, really improvising with a bunch of props. And she can't make a piece of toast. She doesn't know how to percolate coffee. Everything is on fire, smoking, bubbling over. And that was something she really thought up. She said, because she wanted the people out there to think, yeah, Katharine Hepburn's kind of wonderful, but I want every woman to think, yeah, but I can make a better cup of coffee than that woman can. And every guy, she wanted him to be watching the movie and thinking, yeah, that Katharine Hepburn is pretty exciting, but boy, you know, my wife, she at least knows how to make me breakfast.
Was the movie going to have that ending, or is that something, how is that movie supposed to end before Katharine Hepburn improvised the kitchen ending?
Yeah, initially, the film was just going to end with their being married, and one just sort of assumed that they went off together, and that was that.
Happily ever after.
Happily ever after, and yet the director, the writer, Hepburn, and Tracy both had this kind of funny feeling about it that it suggested that Katharine Hepburn, that her character, Tess Harding, got everything she wanted in the world, and she really had to pay no price. And there seemed to be something arrogant about that, and something slightly unreal about that. And so they all felt they should somehow try to show that she was not this superwoman, that she really had faults and foibles of her own. And so that improvised ending, they thought, addressed that, and I think it does, too.
My guest is A. Scott Berg, author of the new book, Kate Remembered. Here's a scene from the 1940 film, The Philadelphia Story, with Hepburn and Cary Grant as a divorced couple.
I never saw you looking better, Red. You're getting that fine, tawny look.
Oh, we're going to talk about me, are we? Goody.
It's astonishing what money can do for people, don't you agree, Mr. Connor? Not too much, you know, just more than enough. Now, take Tracy, for example. There's never a blow that hasn't been softened for her. Never a blow that won't be softened. As a matter of fact, it even changed her shape. She was a dumpy little thing at one time.
Only as it happens, I'm not interested in myself for the moment.
Not interested in yourself? You're fascinated, Red. You're far and away your favorite person in the world.
Dexter, in case you don't know...
Of course, Mr. Connor. She's a girl who's generous to a fault.
To a fault, Mr. Connor?
Except to other people's faults. For instance, she never had any understanding of my deep and gorgeous thirst.
That was your problem.
Granted. But you took on that problem with me when you took me, Red. You were no helpmate there. You were a scold.
It was disgusting. It made you so unattractive.
A weakness, sure. And strength is her religion, Mr. Connor. She finds human imperfection unforgivable.
We'll talk more about Katharine Hepburn after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is A. Scott Berg. He's written a new memoir about Katharine Hepburn. They were friends for a little over 20 years. The book is called Kate Remembered. You met Katharine Hepburn when she was 75, and you were close to her until her death. Did she worry a lot about death? Was she afraid of death? Was she afraid of facing pain or suffering before death?
We talked about dying and death on many occasions, actually, especially in the last several years. She often said she was not afraid of death. I think she had some fears of dying and how that might go. I believe now, I have reason to believe, she was in a little more pain than I thought then. But one would never know it from her.
Pain from what?
As it turns out, she did die from the official reason she died was, I was told, cessation of breathing. She did have a tumor, a rather aggressive tumor, however, growing in her neck, really between her larynx and her ear, and got to be really large. And I have to assume that really hurt. My last visit with her, which was really it was a month before she died, and it was the first time I really thought, okay, I think she's really dying now. It was the first time I had seen her with a loss of appetite. And of course, once I heard about this tumor, I thought, well, every swallow must be incredibly difficult for her. Maybe that's part of the reason she's not eating. But it's not as if she ever said as much. She really fought it. She was amazing.
Did you ever wonder if when you left, when she was like behind closed doors or only with, somebody who was helping to take care of her, that she was different, that she succumbed more to pain?
I did think that. I hoped that, to be perfectly honest with you. It's just so much to carry around, and I just kept waiting for some steam to come out of the valve.
Right.
I do know that being said, I mean, you raise a really good question, because whenever I was there, certainly, I know she put on her best face. I mean, literally she did. On some of my last visits with her, I know she asked to have a little lipstick put on her, which she never did in the first 15 or 16 years that I knew her. So clearly she wanted to be at her best. But that was true of me with her. I always wanted to be at my best, too.
Katharine Hepburn developed a shake later in life, and some people thought she might have Parkinson's disease. Did she have it, and was she self-conscious about that shake?
She always said she did not have Parkinson's, that she just shook, and that there was a history of shaking in her family. And as for the self-consciousness, it's quite interesting. I don't think she was self-conscious at all about it. And the proof of that is we've seen her shake in the movies. And I can't think of another actress who would have remained in the films with that shake. And somehow it's so much part of her character that, you know, this is one of the reasons why I think Katharine Hepburn lives on as a film star, because she allowed herself to age in the public eye, in those movies. And she allowed us to see what the aging process was. And shaking was part of that. And so in the end, the fact that Katharine Hepburn had this shake really became a rather endearing quality about her.
Did she know that the book was done? That you had written it, that it was finished, that it was ready to go?
I don't think she ever did know it, because I never raised the fact that I had actually sat down and started to write the book. Around 1999, after I had finished with my Lindbergh book and I had promoted the book, I went home, and before I got started on my new work on Woodrow Wilson, I pulled out all my notebooks, my transcripts, hundreds of scraps of paper, little post-its and whatnot, and began to put them all together. And I thought, you know what? Now is the time to write this book. And I discussed it with my publisher. Originally, I had thought that I wouldn't even start writing it until she had died. My publishers assured me, however, that it could be kept a secret. And they said, if you actually write it now, which they said was a really good idea, because then you don't have to break your flow when you're actually doing your Wilson book. If you write it now, we promise nobody will know about it. And you will work with just a handful of people individually, so they won't even know who else is working on the book or that even such a book exists. And when you tell us the day has come, we'll pull it out of the safe and we'll publish it.
The safe?
Yes, it was literally kept in a vault at Putnam's. It was locked up. Once I had finished it, I worked with my editor on Lindbergh, Phyllis Grant, who edited the book. And then that was sent to a copy editor, and that was sent to a book designer. And each person did her own work on the book. And once that they had done it, it was just locked up, literally since spring of 2001. It's just been sitting there in a vault.
Were the people who worked on it sworn to secrecy?
They were. And I'll tell you, this is a rather nice part of the story. They were sworn to secrecy, and I had a conversation with each of them on why it was a secret. And it was basically for one big reason, and that is, I said, look, Katharine Hepburn is now in her 90s. She's going to die soon. There was a period there where a lot of news people were kind of keeping death watch around the house, people trying to break through on the phone, get into the house, get a picture of Katharine Hepburn. And I said, I cannot in any way contribute to that. And if anybody gets a whiff that there's a book that is going to be published upon her death, they will presume she is now in her final moments, and they will start to hang around the house again. And I just can't have that. I can't in any way contribute to any unrest for her. And each of the people who worked on this book at Putnam's, they were so remarkable. They took this to heart because they really felt, or I felt that they felt, that this was a kind of contribution they could make to Katharine Hepburn's life. They could somehow, by doing their work and being so private and quiet about it, they could let her live and die in peace. And indeed, the day she died, there was not a soul around. There was not a single member of the press corps around. And by the time the press began to show up, her body had long been driven off from the house.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
A. Scott Berg is the author of Kate Remembered. Here's Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant in a scene from the 1938 comedy Bringing Up Baby. She's sitting at a bar and drops an olive. He's walking by and slips on it.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, hello. You're sitting on your hat.
I know it.
That's silly.
I'm awfully sorry. I couldn't be more apologetic, really.
Well, I might have known you were here. I had a feeling just as I hit the floor.
That was your hat.
Yeah. Look at it.
Yes, it's too bad, isn't it? Well, Joe here was showing me a trick and the olive got away.
First you drop an olive, and then I sit on my hat. It all fits perfectly.
Oh, yes, but you can't do that trick without dropping some of the olives. It takes practice.
What, to sit on my hat?
No, to drop an olive. Yeah. Now, if you're going to be angry with me, what can I do?
Go away.
No, I was here first.
Then I'll go away.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by tenor saxophonist Virginia Mayhew. This is Fresh Air. Saxophonist Virginia Mayhew comes from California, where she played gigs with Cab Calloway, Earl Hines, and Frank Zappa. After moving to New York, she sat in with several big bands, including Toshiko Akiyoshi's and the women's jazz orchestra Diva. Later in the year, she'll do a State Department tour of Southeast Asia. Mayhew came up playing alto saxophone, but features the heftier tenor on a new quartet CD. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the bigger horn suits her as well as the company she keeps.
Saxophonist Virginia Mayhew on Cole Porter's I Love You. The spiffy staccato arrangement, the way trumpeter Ingrid Jensen fills in behind that solo, the way the drummer and bassist sync up so you don't miss a piano, that's the sound of quality workmanship. It's typical of Mayhew's quartet CD, Phantoms, whose pleasures have at least as much to do with the way the parts fit together as the parts themselves. You could also say that about New Orleans jazz or Count Basie's rhythm section. The sound is built from strong instrumental voices, starting with the leaders. Virginia Mayhew has a nice mix of brawny tone and lyrical conception on tenor. Her playing on soprano sax brings out her melodic side, too. Either horn dovetails with Ingrid Jensen's warm tone and jabbing attack on trumpet or flugelhorn. The tuneful bassist is Harvey S. He used to be known as Harvey Swartz, and on bass is Allison Miller, something of a melodist herself. Thank you. Babble On by composer Steve Swallow. Despite high spirits there and elsewhere, a subdued air hangs over much of this New York music recorded last fall. Virginia Mayhew says that in some tunes she picked, quoting here, "There was an underlying feeling that reflected the way the tragedies of September 11th affected me on an emotional level." That's Phantoms by Kenny Barron, written before 9-1-1. It's redolent of New Yorkers' fortitude and forbearance anyway, but then musicians and listeners bring their own baggage to this or any music. The elegiac quality of Virginia Mayhew's CD suggests the wisdom of dealing with that massive civic trauma indirectly. She catches some of the city's mood in the aftermath, including a willingness to pull together to make things work.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed Phantoms, the new CD by saxophonist Virginia Mayhew. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Schurach. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by Benny Carter. The saxophonist, composer, arranger, and bandleader died Saturday at the age of 95. His recording career spanned from the 1920s to the 1990s. This is his 1936 recording of one of his best-known compositions, When Lights Are Low.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, war photographer Christopher Morris. He's documented drug violence in Colombia, civil war in the former Yugoslavia, and the first Gulf War. His recent photographs from Iraq are included in the new Time magazine book, 21 Days to Baghdad. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.